who's responsible. It's whoever sent him. Find out, Reese. And don't feel 1 ounce of pity. Did you see the prison tattoos? This is going to take a bit of work. Reese and Liz secured the Russian to the plane's Israeli stretcher with wrap upon wrap of rigger's tape and maneuvered him through the hatch and up to Thorne's cabin. Steps offered access to a spacious yet rickety deck adorned with a basic black Weber grill, showing its age, next to a handmade picnic table. Liz opened the door, allowing Reese to take stock of his surroundings. It was a humble structure by necessity, quite literally cut from the wilderness. Each and every piece had been flown in or borrowed from the surrounding environment. The result looked more like a trapper's cabin than an escape for one of the wealthiest men in Montana. And that was just what Thorne was after. The main room hosted a small kitchen, one round table, and an old iron wood-burning stove. A loft with a narrow staircase overlooked the gathering area, and a short hallway led to 2 guest bedrooms. Tall trees surrounded the refuge, filtering the late afternoon sunlight and leaving the room in perpetual shadow. It was perfect. Let's get him in a chair. I'll take it from there. Chapter 51. Community Agricultural Project, Moldavia, Romania. The sun was setting as Hannah Hastings leaned against the fender of her Renault pickup, making notes on her tablet. The harvest was going well, despite a lack of modern combines. The single machine they had dated back to the 1970s and had already broken down twice. What these farmers lacked in technology, they made up for in resilience. When the machinery malfunctioned, the most skilled mechanics of the group would go to work on it, despite a complete lack of replacement parts. While those repairs were taking place, the community came out and continued the harvest with hand tools, just as they'd done for centuries. These were hard men and women from a harsh land. They reminded her of her family in Montana. Windswept hills provided fertile soil, but droughts threatened to ruin crops and crush wills. Hannah had received a grant to dig a well, build a basic irrigation system, and introduce the local farmers to modern seeds and chemical fertilizers. The results of their efforts were paying off. This year's yield appeared to be the best that anyone could remember, despite a relatively dry summer. Hannah was a horticulturalist and crop specialist with a master's degree from Utah State University. She had been born in the United States after her family had immigrated to Montana, and as the baby of the family, she had always rooted for the underdog. She was only 8 years old when she found her first cause. The ranch hands had moved some cattle to a fresh pasture, and a newborn calf had been separated from the herd. They quickly discovered the oversight and reunited the calf with the herd, but her mother would not claim her. The calf was dehydrated and weak when Hannah first became aware of her plight. Caroline drove her to the feed store in Winfred, where she used her allowance to buy a nursing bottle and a large bag of milk replacer. She also made a deal with her father. If the calf survived, she would never be sent to auction. Jonathan reluctantly agreed. He'd never been good about saying no to his youngest daughter. She named the calf Patches and nursed her back to health in a hastily built pen. Patches regained her strength and was soon able to rejoin the herd, living a long life and having many calves of her own. Those calves earned thousands of dollars in revenue for the ranch, which Jonathan dutifully placed into Hannah's savings account. One of the family's favorite photos was a snapshot of Hannah sitting inside Patches's pen with her legs crossed, bottle feeding her rescued calf. It came as no surprise when Hannah turned down a potentially lucrative career with a seed company and chose to work for an NGO educating farmers in developing countries. She was currently helping modernize the farming practices of one of the poorest countries in the European Union. She stayed in touch with her family through email and Skype and planned to return to Montana for Christmas. Her father always joked that Hannah was the bleeding heart of the family, but that wasn't exactly true. Though she was incredibly compassionate, she was very much of the teach-them-to-fish mindset. Her father was right about one thing, though. She couldn't save the entire world by herself. She looked forward to going home in a few short months. She'd been away too long. An hour later, Hannah picked at her dinner at the small table that served as a dining room, her laptop next to her. The living conditions of the small farmstead apartment should have been uncomfortable for a wealthy American, but she had a genuine appreciation for the simplicity of it all. She tried to email her parents, but the farm's satellite internet signal was down, as usual. Headlights flashed across the ceiling as a vehicle turned onto her lane, the beams casting eerie shadows as they filtered through the high window frames. She heard footfalls on the stone walkway as a figure approached. Visitors after nightfall were not a normal occurrence. Listening to her sixth sense, Hannah looked around for something to use as a weapon and picked up a battered kitchen knife. The knock at the door sent a shiver down her spine, but a woman's voice put her at ease.
"Excuse me,"
the woman said in Romanian. Hannah peeked through the window shade and saw a young, well-dressed female.
"Can I help you?"
"My husband and I are lost. Is this the road to the bed and breakfast?"
She could see that the woman was holding a smartphone, presumably trying to find a location on the map that would not come up due to that lack of coverage in the area. Still suspicious, Hannah unlocked the door and stepped out to help, holding the knife in her right hand, the blade pressed upward against her forearm to conceal it. The woman smiled and held out the phone so that Hannah could see the map. She leaned in to see where she was pointing.
"Thank you so much."
Hannah opened her mouth to respond, but was grabbed in a powerful bear hug from behind. She slashed backward with the knife and felt the resistance of clothing, flesh, and bone. The vice grip loosened as her attacker grunted in pain. Twisting away, she turned and ran back through the doorway, sprinting through her home for the back door that led into the night. If she could get out of the house, she would have a 200-yard dash to the forest. She heard footsteps behind her and threw a chair into the doorway to slow her pursuer.
"Almost there. The back door. A chance to escape."
Slamming her shoulder into the back door, she catapulted herself toward the tree line and was knocked to the ground with a 2x4 to the face. She fell backward, crashing back into the door frame, the knife slipping from her grasp. Bloodied and barely conscious against the side of the house, she had no defense when the man she had stabbed appeared and struck the left side of her head. Before the others pulled him off, he landed another blow where her jawline met her ear, sending her spiraling into darkness. Chapter 52. Boundary County, Idaho, United States-Canadian border. He'd seen the technique once before, and it had stayed with him. Having been attached to the CIA in the days when IEDs became a tactical weapon of strategic importance, Reese had witnessed the unleashing of the most aggressive elements of the U.S. intelligence apparatus. Though Americans were strictly prohibited from practicing the darkest arts of tactical interrogation, they could teach host nation forces some of the more refined elicitation methods and then leave the room when partner force interrogators applied their most recent knowledge on the enemy. Reese knew the importance of maintaining the moral high ground in war. Sometimes that's all that distinguished the good guys from the bad. If you abandoned the moral high ground, all was lost.
"You've lost your way, Reese. Tell that to your wife and daughter."
Reese swung the med kit from his shoulder and looked at the man strapped naked to the leather chair in front of him. Reese and Liz had set the chair on a tarp to help contain the inevitable DNA. Rigger's tape secured the prisoner's legs, arms, and upper chest to the chair. A rope fixed in a noose was looped securely around his head
and was tied to a beam running the length of the cabin. He wasn't going anywhere. The man was covered in ink. Almost every inch of his body was overwritten by intricate tattoos. Saints, angels, skulls, and coffins covered his chest and back. A giant cathedral with multiple domes dominated the scene. A hooded executioner branded each shoulder, and roses stood out from his forearms, one twisting around a dagger, the other wrapped in barbed wire. Rhys didn't know much about Russian tattoos, but what he did know was that they signified the man before him had spent time in some of the toughest prisons on Earth and survived. While working for the CIA, Rhys had learned techniques carefully designed to elicit responses from the most hardened Islamic terrorists. What he took away was that regardless of the technique, as an interrogator, you had to offer hope. Hope was the key. He wondered how it would work with a hardened Bratva enforcer. He was about to find out. Rhys moved forward and felt the pulse at the man's neck, slow and weak. He needed the Russian alive for at least an hour. Returning to the med kit, Rhys took out an IV and a length of 550 cord. He threw the cord over the exposed beam that held the noose and attached it to the IV bag dangling just to the side of the Russian's head. His veins stood out like pipes, probably due to the copious amounts of steroids that sustained his muscular physique. Rhys stabbed the needle of the 18-gauge catheter into a vein running through the rose and dagger on his subject's right arm. He pulled the hub, withdrawing the needle and leaving the plastic sheath in the vein. He then attached the tube and opened the IV spin valve to flood the tubing with fluid after taping it to the arm. He ran the bag wide open to replace the fluids necessary to stabilize the Russian for questioning. When the first bag had drained, Rhys attached a second, watching an air bubble move down the tube. "Enjoy your rest, my friend," Rhys whispered. "You'll need all your strength for what's coming." "And so will I," Rhys thought. The Scoville scale measures heat in Scoville heat units, in this case specifically the heat of peppers, a heat that comes from the neuropeptide-releasing agent capsaicin, which they contain. Rhys put on rubber gloves and clear eyeglasses from the med kit and dumped Jonathan's red ghost peppers out on a cutting board in the small kitchen. Rhys was after the capsaicin. He'd seen the process done in sterile conditions at the CIA over a series of days. Rhys didn't have days, he had hours. He was going to do what SEALs did best: improvise. Preheating the oven to 350 degrees, he moved back to the cutting board and sliced the ghost peppers down the middle, removing the seeds and separating the white pith that contained the capsaicin. Careful not to touch his face, he put the pith on a baking sheet and threw it in the oven to dry it out. Opening and closing cupboards, Rhys found what he was looking for: a coffee grinder, French press, and a bottle of Jack Daniels. Sinatra Select, not bad, Rhys thought. 5 minutes later, Rhys returned to the oven and removed his baking sheet. He then slid the dried pith into the hand grinder, which he cranked over a bowl, turning it into a coarse powder. He then added 4 shots of Jack Daniel's finest and began to stir. If time was not of the essence, he would have let it sit for a week or two in pure alcohol. "I hope this works." When the consistency was that of slush, he poured it into the French press and pushed down on the strainer, leaving a hazy, brownish solution of pure liquid. Carefully, Rhys filled a 60cc syringe with his concoction, remembering the CIA doctor who had taught him this technique all those years ago. When Rhys had asked how hot it was, the doctor had answered, "If you were eating a jalapeno pepper, it would measure about 5,000 Scoville heat units. This solution has a Scoville heat unit measurement of over 3 million. It will burn them alive from the inside out, but without the fire. The Russian's head was beginning to sway, signifying the fentanyl was wearing off. Good. Reese sealed his resolve and approached the man he hoped had answers. Reese brought his leg up and slammed it down directly on the Russian's broken leg, eliciting an animalistic scream. Reese stepped behind him and tore the rigger's tape from his eyes, then grabbed a chair from the small kitchen table and turned it around so that its back was facing his subject. He sat down, rubber gloves, eye protection, and syringe all clearly visible to the Russian, who blinked his eyes and slowly took in his surroundings. "Hi," Reese said as pleasantly as possible. "I'm James Reese. You tried to kill me and Rafe Hastings earlier today. I have some questions for you." The Russian's breathing was slow and labored. His head was restrained by the noose, but his eyes moved to his leg, then back to Reese. In heavily accented English, he responded,
"My leg. Something for my leg."
"Oh, don't worry about your leg. That's about to be the very least of your problems." One of the first rules of interrogation was to only ask questions to which you already knew the answers. Reese started with what he already knew from his phone call with Vic Rodriguez. "Let's start with an easy one. Who is Ivan Zharkov?"
"Сейчас поебалу получишь, сука, блядь!"
The Russian spat, his muscles straining to break free of the tape that kept him securely in place. Without a word, Reese stood and walked behind him and grabbed the noose, wrenching his head back and to the side, slamming his free hand onto his adversary's face and prying his right eye open. With the syringe, Reese administered a drop of the capsaicin solution and stepped back. The effect was immediate. The Russian's eye turned an instantaneous red, and his mouth opened in a roar of agony from a level of pain he had never experienced, body thrashing as his hands desperately fought to break free of the tape that bound them to the chair. Had they been free, he would have ripped his own eyeball from his head, the agony feeling like a blade pivoting through his eye from the deep recesses of his brain. "That's one drop, comrade," Reese said. "I have this entire syringe and more where that came from. Let's try that again. Who is Ivan Zharkov?" The Russian blinked, blood tears running down his face, his body doing its best to clear itself of this foreign invader. Then, taking a moment, he took in his antagonizer. This was James Reese, his target. He knew Ivan should have used a team from Wagner Group. He was a bratok in the Bratva. He hadn't broken in Black Dolphin prison, and he certainly wouldn't break for this American. Ivan Zharkov had gotten him out of that hellhole. The Pakhan would get him out of this one. He was almost a brigadier in the organization. He would not break.
"Cigarette?"
the Russian asked. "Nope, those things will kill you." The Russian looked at his tormentor.
"Сука, блядь!"
he said, attempting to spit at Reese. "I was afraid you might say that. Don't go anywhere," Reese said, standing and returning to the med kit. "He's not giving you a choice, Reese." Reese closed his eyes and took a breath, seeing a vision of the Russian standing above a gagged and bound Katie, terror in her eyes. Reese selected another 60cc syringe and filled it with tap water. He then ripped open a Foley catheter bag from the kit and emptied its contents on the table. "Do it, Reese." Reese opened the 14-gauge catheter and lubed it with the provided KY jelly. He then turned and marched back to his subject. Ignoring the stream of threats in Russian, Reese grabbed his prisoner's penis with his gloved hand and threaded the catheter down his urethra. Unable to move, the Russian continued to thrash his head as much as the noose would allow. Reese applied pressure to his captive's broken femur with his elbow and only stepped back when he saw yellow urine appear in the drainage bag. Reese then attached a 10cc syringe preloaded with saline to a side port, which blew up a small balloon, anchoring